coming up on Philosophy Talk.
In strict adherence to book club guidelines, I have been drinking Chardonnay since 1 p.m.
The surf is up.
The sun is out.
Summer is on.
Time to head to the beach with a good book in hand.
Do I put it in my fiction section up here with my Tom Clancy and The Origin of Species and... Or do I put it down here in nonfiction with The Bible and Watership Down?
What better way to spend a summer evening than curled up with a good philosophy book?
Bathe in the summer sun as you while away the hours exploring the upper reaches of philosophical thought.
It is going to be a literary phenomenon of narrative deconstruction and symbolic analysis. Plus, together, we will discover how many copies of the book you'll need to level your kitchen table.
It's our annual philosophical summer reading list.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're in San Francisco coming to you from the studios of KALW.
Continuing conversations that begin on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I spend our summers reading and doing philosophy.
Today, it's our annual summer reading show.
Every year, with the help of you, our community of thinkers, we compile a philosophical summer reading list, thought-provoking books for thoughtful people. We'll hear some of these recommendations later in the program.
We'll also talk about one of our own choices for summer reading, a big book that's having a huge impact, Capital in the 21st Century by the French economist Thomas Piketty.
And we'll hear from some special guests who've got books of their own that we think would make great summer reading for us.
So, John, I know you were probably hatched from your mother's womb doing philosophy, but what was the actual first reading experience that gripped you philosophically?
Oh, it was when I was in high school. I stumbled across Will Durant's book, The Story of Philosophy. It's nicely written, focuses on some famous philosophers, and among them, the one that really resonated with me was Schopenhauer. Like all teenage boys, I just found women a mystery, and so did Schopenhauer. And I love Schopenhauer with his dour, nasty view of human life. It just somehow resonated with my teenage angst. Terrific introduction to philosophy. Now, Ken, how about you? It's hard to imagine you not as a philosopher, but there must have been some book that got you into it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I didn't start out knowing anything about philosophy. I encountered lots of philosophy at Notre Dame, but it didn't really grip me all that much until I read Hume's Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. And like Kant, I was awoken from my slumbers. It wasn't dogmatic slumbers, but I was awoken from my slumbers. I read, then I reread. I stayed up nights. I explained Hume to all my friends who thought I was like, why are you so obsessed about this? But I was really obsessed. I could not get Hume's stuff out of my mind. I just couldn't do it.
Well, there's no telling how early you can get someone interested in philosophically minded reading.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to find out how to get children reading and thinking philosophically right from the start. She files this report.
When you think of philosophy, you don't usually think about little kids. But some children's books are filled with philosophical truths or conundrums. Take Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree. Here's a refresher on the story.
Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy.
It's about this kid and this tree that get friends. The tree gives apple to the kid, and they play hide and seek.
The tree also ends up giving the boy his branches, and then his trunk. At the end of the story, the boy is an old man, and the tree is only a stump. And the man uses the stump to sit down and rest.
Come, boy. Come sit down. Sit down and rest.
That raises a few questions. Was the boy being selfish? And why would the tree want to give everything he had to the boy?
Because all the tree wanted to do was help the boy and make the boy happy.
Okay, but was the tree happy? And if you were the tree, could you be happy being nothing more than a stump?
You're talking about questions for which you can't say, well, let's just Google it.
That's Jana Moore Lone, director of the University of Washington's Center for Philosophy for Children.
I mean, you can Google it, but you're not going to end up with a final answer on that one, right?
Right. The idea that kids can learn to think philosophically came to Morlone when her first son was 5 years old. He started asking her questions that she really didn't know how to answer.
They were questions like, why do we have thoughts? Or are numbers real? And I realized that these were genuine philosophical questions.
So Morlone decided to do a little test. She talked her son's kindergarten teacher into letting her do a philosophy session with the students. She wanted to see if other children were as inquisitive as her own son.
I brought in a story from Frog and Toad Together called Dragons and Giants.
Then the brave knight rode against the dragon with all his speed, thrusting his spear straight at the fiery dragon's jaws.
The story led us into a really interesting discussion about bravery and what bravery is and whether you can be brave and afraid at the same time. And that was kind of the beginning.
Morlone now teaches philosophy undergraduates how to go into elementary school classrooms and have these kind of philosophical conversations with the kids. The questions the kids come up with can be pretty surprising. Morlone says one day she was teaching a fourth grade class and got into a long conversation about the meaning of life.
A young girl raised her hand and said, well, I have a question. I'm wondering about my life. I'm going to school so that eventually I can go to college, so I can get a good job and have a family and support them, and then eventually I'm going to die. And what is the purpose of all this?
And this was a 10-year-old. Studies show that teaching kids to think philosophically can actually make children smarter.
Thinking about these very hard questions in this kind of open and safe intellectual environment helps them to develop very strong intellectual analytic skills.
It also improves cognitive test scores and increases a child's ability for communication, confidence, and empathy. But most importantly, says Morlone, it nurtures children's capacity for wonder.
The children see that there are many ways to approach these questions and that there are lots of different perspectives about how to see the world.
So books like Frog and Toad aren't just keeping children entertained. They're helping kids think philosophically.
We're not afraid!
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow philosopher from Stanford, Ken Taylor.
It's our annual summer reading show. And one book that's got many people buzzing, it's A Work of Economics. It's sure to be on many people's reading list this summer. It definitely should be on yours. That's Capital in the 21st Century by the French economist Thomas Piketty.
We're joined now by Shannon Stimson. She's a professor of political science at UC Berkeley. She's co-author of After Adam Smith, A Century of Transformation in Politics and Political Economy. Shannon, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So look, lots of people are buzzing about this book by Thomas Piketty. It's gotten great reviews. It's gotten negative reviews. I wonder, what do you think? Is it worth reading this summer, or is it worth putting on our summer reading list, and why?
I think it is definitely worth reading. Piketty's an extremely interesting thinker. It is a controversial book, and so I would definitely suggest that they read him first rather than Chris Giles of the Financial Times or Paul Krugman. Read him first, and they can read him because it's not only a work that can be read without calculus, but it's historically sophisticated. And how many contemporary economic texts have you read that discusses Balzac's Perigorio?
Exactly.
It teaches you the lesson to marry a rich man's daughter. It's much better road to success than working hard. Or Tolstoy's Ibiscus, and the lesson there is wealth and merit are unrelated.
So you sound pretty enthusiastic. Now, this has about the same title as Marx's great three-volume Das Kapital. Is the message similar?
No, it's not a similar message, but it is a similar approach to look at the internal logic of capital. The interesting thing is, this is not a book strictly about exorbitant income. There's no question that at the very top, incomes, that is, we call them salaries, have risen astronomically. But he is talking about increases ultimately in what would be inherited wealth. Mm-hmm. That is, not salaried wealth, but capital. And the question is a very old question, back to the point, interesting point you made about Marx. Marx asked a very interesting question, and that is, do the dynamics of wealth accumulation inevitably lead to the concentration of wealth in ever fewer hands? And Piketty asks that question. He doesn't answer it in the manner that Marx did, because he believes it's soluble, and Marx didn't believe it was soluble, obviously. But he answers that question in the affirmative. Yes, the dynamics of wealth accumulation can, in fact, lead to the concentration of wealth in ever fewer hands. And the problem is not what Marx thought it would be, the immiseration of those below, but an ever greater yawning gap in wealth accumulation at the top. And if I can add something to that, with the Supreme Court we have at present, that wealth can be politically destabilizing.
I want to explore that. That's what I want to explore. Why this matters to the person in the polity, the person
right.
on the street. Because let me put out a contrarian thought
sure.
that I heard from a colleague of mine who will remain nameless. She said, why do you care about how much wealth the rich have? I mean, as long as you have enough of all the good things in life, and she says there's no reason to believe that this concentration of wealth is will be correlated with a concentration of the good things to the wealthy class. So if we have free equal access to the political system, this, that, and the other thing, there's no reason to believe that concentration of wealth brings with it concentration of other good things.
Yeah. What difference does it make if there's a vast sort of an unbelievably vast distance from the top of the pyramid to the bottom? And the answer to that, I think, turns on what we see even today, which is, in America at least, there is every evidence to suggest that the wealthy are very good at using their money to manipulate politics, and they're getting better. I mean, even if we have one person, one vote, that's a very naive way to look at how both issues and outcomes are shaped in the contemporary economic sphere.
But that suggests that we might... Okay, there's two sets of policies we could have in response to this. We could have policies that, as it were, redistribute the wealth, right, that try to close the wealth gap through taxations. Or we could have a set of policies that guard against the impact of the concentration of wealth on the distribution of other things. So if we have public schooling, I mean, you might think that you can't have the one without the other. So if we have great public schools for everybody, rather than just a private school system, that ameliorates the...
Yeah. Well, I think, again, if you're asking me what Piketty seems to be suggesting, I would call him essentially a social democrat, but a firm believer in the market. No question about that. He just doesn't believe that one important element of its internal logic can be left unresponded to, so that he suggests a progressive taxation on wealth, on capital. Mm-hmm. And that tax would not be a one-time levy. That would be annual.
Yeah, right.
And the interesting thing about that is the point for him is not revenue. It's to re-equilibrate the system. It's to diminish the wealth gap between the rate of return on capital and the growth rate of income, and to keep it down to what has been thought to be historically manageable rates, which is essentially four to one.
Now, Shannon, I've always believed on the basis of philosophy and first principles that anyone who earns $10,000 more a year than I do should have heavy, heavy, heavy taxation. This sounds like it's giving a kind of an empirical basis for this a priori belief of mine.
Yeah, I think Piketty could win the Nobel Prize for this book.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So we must read it, and we will read it, and we thank you so much for giving us a quick tour of this book.
Thank you.
Shannon Stimson from UC Berkeley and her thoughts on Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're putting together our annual summer reading list.
What's on your list? We've got a great book. It's the latest effort from a writer we love. She's trying to ensure that deep thinking on deep topics won't go away.
A conversation with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein when Philosophy Talk continues.
One day I read a book. I can't remember when. But one of these days I'm going to do it again. Yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
We're doing it again. It's the summer reading list edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're compiling a list of thought-provoking books for thoughtful people to read this summer.
We're joined now by a most thoughtful person, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She's a prolific writer, author most recently of Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. Rebecca, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be back.
So I got to tell you, that question, why philosophy won't go away, you could ask that in at least two different tones. You could say, why philosophy won't go away, like defiantly. Or you could say, you know, why hasn't philosophy gone away? Why aren't you guys going away already? Aren't we finished with that?
Yeah, and that's what I hear a lot of, actually.
Oh, me too. I mean, and you take on that physicist, Lawrence Krauss?
Lawrence Krauss, yeah, who went on record, yes.
Yeah, and another guy's gone on record, the astrophysicist who's the host of Cosmos. I love Cosmos.
But yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson. That was unfortunate.
Yeah, on a podcast just the other day, I heard him really dissing our discipline.
Yeah, a waste of time.
So tell me, I'm sure, philosophy talk listeners, you probably don't have to convince, but the world, you probably do have to convince. So what's the kind of short answer about why philosophy won't go away?
I guess we get it from both sides. We get it from scientists sometimes, not all of them, of course, but some of them. Steven Weinberg, you know, the Nobel laureate, is also dissed philosophy. And, you know, some very young, brilliant, brilliant scientists. But we also, of course, get it from religion as well, you know, that religion can answer all the questions of values and science answers all the questions of facts. So what are you guys doing except making trouble? And I was particularly interested in the book in scientists who, because, you know, we're on the same side of rationality, and it just seems... It's really regrettable. But I think, you know, in general, philosophy is let me back up a moment. Even for scientists to make the case that philosophy is going to disappear, that science is going to exhaust or appropriate all of the questions of philosophy, they're usually depending on philosophy to make that case. They need a criterion of demarcation between scientific descriptions and other descriptions. They need to make a case for scientific realism. They are, you know, assuming a lot of philosophical work, even in arguing against philosophy's usefulness.
That's right. And in your book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, you kind of take on these kind of issues head on. You kind of argue directly that these philosophy naysayers are themselves engaging in philosophy.
Yes, right. Not realizing and, you know, and just appropriating conclusions. You know, usually the one and only philosopher whom they approve of is Karl Popper, as far as they're concerned.
Right.
He's the only useful man who ever said anything.
Right. Well, a lot of scientists, and I have in mind here particularly computer scientists, they have a lot of nice things to say about dead philosophers. I mean, all computer scientists think that Alan Turing was a great guy, but they don't like it when live philosophers ask them questions they don't know how to answer. John Searle made a lot of enemies in computer science with his Chinese room example.
Yeah.
That really, you know, it just force people to think about what really is it to understand language. And you could see that computer scientists just didn't like the fact that they'd solved all these incredibly difficult questions and done all this incredibly difficult good work, and then some philosopher comes on and asks them a question that they really don't know how to answer, and they get defensive. And I think, you know, when you have quantum physicists telling us things that they can't even explain, when you have people talking about the Big Bang and then you say something like, well, what happened before the Big Bang? And they just find it irritating because they work so hard to come up with these answers. They don't want to be told that there's something missing.
Rebecca, one of the things you do in this book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, the way you demonstrate this is through this amazing form, by reusing this amazing form that Plato created, the Platonic dialogue itself, right, with Plato in the place of Socrates. Socrates was the main protagonist in Plato's dialogues. Plato's the main protagonist in your dialogues. Why did you choose that dialogue for?
Why did I choose that dialogue forum? I love the dialogue forum. And of course, I've had lots of practice producing dialogues when I have my other hat on as a novelist, right? So, this to me is an extremely effective way of pursuing philosophical questions and, the back and forth. And but the thing that really put the idea in my head, I hadn't started out with this idea, was I hear philosophy being discussed all the time, right? It's people are talking about how to raise their children and should we want them, ought we to want them to be successful or happy or high achievers or just good people? And I hear Plato, right, talking there or, at the last dialogue, I have Plato going and getting a brain scan. He's participating in an experiment. He's a volunteer. I did it. I went and volunteered over at Harvard, so I know what it was like, so I could describe it. And he gets into a dialogue with two neuroscientists about whether or not questions like free will, personal identity, moral responsibility have been answered finally, conclusively, empirically by the brain scientists. So these questions they permeate our contemporary discussions, politics as well. I have them on Fox News. I don't actually identify as Fox News.
Cable.
Yeah. And, talking
cable
about
cable news network.
Yeah. One cable news network. And, talking about democracy and morality. Do we need religion in order to know the difference between right and wrong and all of it? People are talking about hardcore philosophy all the time. It's in our dialogue, so why not bring back the man who created it?
I love that aspect of your book, and I do want to say I'm on a hobby horse about this because philosophers used to do this thing that you do, write in dialogues, pensées, essays, meditations. We used to do all this stuff, and then we got so hyper-academic and pseudo-scientific, and we write these boring treatises that P implies Q and N, and there's long chains of arguments. I really want us to go back to the day, and I think you're helping us go back to the day. I want to go back to the day when philosophical writing was artistic writing, when it had literary style, when it was both philosophy and literary style. So I'm going to tell you something. You're one of my favorite philosophers because you're doing this thing.
Oh,
I love what you're
doing.
Thank
you so much. But I do think it's, since everybody thinks about philosophy, talks about philosophy, I think it's really important who people who do it their whole lives, trained to do it, supposedly well, should make their work not just accessible, but irresistible. That's what I want. I want to make it irresistible so that the great thinking that's done in our discipline can be disseminated.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This is our annual summer reading show. We're talking with Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein.
So, Rebecca, I'm convinced that every Philosophy Talk listener should pick up a copy of Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away by Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein. But how about you? You're presumably not going to take that to the beach. Do you have some other suggestions for summer reading?
So I've got a few of them, actually. The first is just a book that gave me so much pleasure. I mean, my head is still very much still back there in ancient Greece and with Plato and his friends. There's this book by Deborah Nails called The People of Plato, a prosopography of Plato and other Socratics. And to me, this was so enjoyable. It was like a novel because all of these people, not just Socrates and Alcibiades and, Critias, who we all know about from ancient Greek history, but everybody, Phaedrus and Meno and Thrasymachus and Callicles, these were all real people. And Plato's contemporaries knew these people. It was like writing about, Bill Clinton and
Can you give us the author and book once again? I didn't.
It's Deborah Nails, and it's The People of Plato, a prosopography of Plato and other Socratics, and she is a professor of philosophy at Michigan State University, and she just writes so well. I mean, it is such a joy. And then you go back and you read these dialogues, and you know who these people are. They start to read like novels.
Wow, that's really cool. That's really cool. So you have more?
Yes, I do. I have a few more, actually. There are two philosophical novels, then, that I'm going to recommend. One is, again, by a philosopher. Her name is Sheridan Hoff, and I just met her in Tucson at, the Dave Chalmers conference, and she gave me a copy of her book. It's called Mirrors Fathom, and it's a kind of Kierkegaard, it's a great story, it's a mystery, it's a love story, but Kierkegaard hovers in the background.
Wow.
And it's about selves and Kierkegaard's notion of the self, and anyway, it's terrific. And one other. Do you guys know James Morrow? Have you ever heard of the novelist?
No, I haven't.
James?
No.
He is a really philosophical, wild man novelist. It's if you like sort of science fiction and kind of fantasy. But he's got one called Blameless in Abaddon, and it is a romp through theodicy. God isn't dead in this thing, but he's in a coma. And this one guy who's suffering terribly, he's a lawyer. He's a judge. He's a small-town judge. He gets cancer, and his wife dies. And, all sorts of terrible things happen to him, and he decides to bring to charge God with crimes against humanity.
Good
and
for
he
him.
Gets the world court to take, the world court in The Hague to take this case, and it is theodicy. It's just wild.
Wow,
it's wonderful.
Wow, wow. Hey, so Rebecca, this has been a great conversation, and I really do think you're doing something extraordinarily important for philosophy.
Well, thank you so much.
Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thing about a bugger when he's pissed.
Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, author of Plato at the Googleplex, with her own recommendations for great summer reading.
And you're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're compiling our annual summer reading list.
Let's hear from some members of our community of thinkers about what they recommend. Joe in Los Angeles, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So what's your suggestion for our summer reading list?
So I've just finished a great book by Moshe Halbertal. He's an Israeli philosopher and public intellectual. He wrote a book on Maimonides called Maimonides, Life and Thought. It's not really a biography, though. What's interesting about it, it begins with a kind of 100-page biographical sketch, but then it walks you through his major work in a way that only a philosopher really could, a very tight, very clear exposition of his major work.
Now, is there a work by Maimonides that is accessible that a person should try to read at the same time?
Well, it's accessible, maybe not, but definitely worth trying, is his masterwork. It's called The Guide for the Perplexed.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of The Guide for the Perplexed.
Yeah. I mean, he wrote two major works in his life. One was a kind of complete restatement of Jewish law. He wrote that in Hebrew for a Jewish audience. And then when he was older, he wrote The Guide for the Perplexed, which he wrote in Arabic. And he tried to really set forth a very sophisticated answer to people that felt there was a sort of irreconcilable conflict between science and scientific insights and traditional Jewish faith.
Ah, right. Now, a lot of the medieval guys were deeply influenced by Aristotle and were trying to reconcile Aristotelianism and Christianity. I know that there were the Arab philosophers had kind of passed the Aristotle to the Christian philosophers. Where was Maimonides in this old Arabic philosophy, Christian philosophy transmission of Aristotle into the medieval period? Was he an Aristotelian, deeply influenced by it or opposed to it?
He was certainly deeply influenced by it. And I guess the way that Halbertal presents it is Aristotle was the prevailing scientific view of the day.
Right.
With modifications. But basically, Aristotle gave you scientific truth. And for Maimonides, there was one element of Aristotle's thought that posed the deepest conflict with Jewish thought, which was the doctrine of an eternal universe versus a created universe.
Yes.
And Aristotle believed that the universe was eternal, and therefore that was the kind of scientific consensus. And the idea for Maimonides that God created the universe was a central tenet of faith, and also had interesting implications for other things, like the possibility of God's intervention in history at all, and which gives you the possibility of revelation and so on. And so that, as Halbertal presents it, that issue, the issue of whether the universe was created or whether it was eternal, is the deep, deep sublevel of the entire work of the Guide for the Perplexed.
So can you tell me in a slogan or two? I know this would not do any justice to the complicated thought of a complicated philosopher like Maimonides. I'm sure of that. But what was the key to the reconciliation for him?
Well, so that I think is what's most interesting, because Maimonides was an esoteric writer, which means he was writing for at least two audiences at the same time, right? He was writing for the sort of the general public and also for an elite that could understand him on a different level. And so this has led to many different readings of what position he actually arrives at. And what Halbertal does, which I think is a really brilliant way of dealing with this, is he doesn't resolve the different ways in which Maimonides has been read. He presents at least four different readings of the Guide for the Perplexed. And they wind up in very different places. So according to one reading, he actually ends up affirming the eternity of the universe, but still thinks you could be Jewish despite believing that. But according to a different reading, he kind of opens the door for a scientific understanding of the world that allows for an eternity of the universe, but the permissibility, because there's enough doubt in that view, the permissibility of believing in a created universe.
So it sounds like a really complex book. It sounds like a great intellectual kind of biography about an important philosopher underappreciated broadly in the Western philosophical tradition. I know there are many scholars who have studied Maimonides, but he's not somebody who penetrates, say, to introductory philosophy of either the medieval or the early modern period or anything like that. He just doesn't penetrate very much into the philosophical curriculum. Wouldn't you agree with that, John?
Yes, there's this cluster of, you know, Avicenna, who I think was maybe a century before Maimonides, and
right.
Maimonides. I mean, there is this big outpouring of philosophy in that era that's, at least, you know, just speaking from my perspective and my education, tends to get ignored. So this summer I'm going to stop at a Jewish deli and pick up a really good sandwich and take my Maimonides. Who's the author again?
The author's name is Moshe Halbertal, and the book is just called simply Maimonides' Life and Thought.
Okay, that's a great recommendation. So read that together with Guide for the Perplexed, and you'll have a mind-expanding experience this summer.
Thanks, Joseph.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual summer reading show.
In our next segment, we'll hear more suggestions from our community of thinkers. And we'll speak with a Yale philosopher with a new book who's got summer reading recommendations of his own.
More summer reading picks from our special guests and from you when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. It's our annual summer reading show. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
We're joined now by Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University, and he's the author of several books about knowledge and language. But he's got a new project this summer that Ken and I are eager to share with you. Jason, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, John.
So I gathered through the internets and people I know that you're writing a book, you're working hard on a book. This is the kind of book that I think would be good summer reading for our Philosophy Talk fans when you're done with it. So tell us about your book.
Yeah, it's beach reading, Ken. It's on propaganda. It's called Why Propaganda Matters. And what I'm doing is arguing that propaganda, well, I'm giving an analysis of the notion of propaganda. I'm trying to explain with the threat propaganda raises for liberal democracy.
Well, you know, that's a fascinating topic, and I want to dig into it a bit. But I'm trying to think of philosophers I know who have written about propaganda, and I'm coming up short. I know Chomsky's talked a lot about propaganda, and he's sort of philosophical in some of his moods. But this isn't a big topic among philosophers, unless I've missed something, is it?
No, it's not at all. It's the topic of ideology is, of course, a big topic in, say, the Frankfurt School. But in our tradition in philosophy in the United States, it tends to be rather apolitical. Even in political philosophy, you tend to talk about properties of the ideal state, like what a perfect mm-hmm. state looks like. And of course, propaganda is not something that you'd find in the ideal state. So it sort of gets excluded by the structure of political philosophy.
So Jason, philosophers always start with distinctions. And so what do you distinguish propaganda from? What other kinds of written and spoken attempts to persuade should it not be confused with?
Well, propaganda relies on the presence of irrational beliefs. So you can't really discuss the topic of propaganda without discussing flawed ideological beliefs, because flawed ideological beliefs make propaganda possible.
Would you distinguish between, let's say, marketing and propaganda? I mean, marketing tries to move your mind to buy a product or approve a brand, not necessarily through rational persuasion, but presentation to you of it as desirable, as needable. I mean, maybe there's some irrationality there, maybe not, but would you distinguish between sort of mere marketing from propaganda?
That's a great question, Ken. As usual, you go right to the heart of the matter. In some languages, advertising and propaganda are the same word. But propaganda is neutral in a lot of languages. So in Mandarin and in Spanish, it doesn't have the pejorative connotation it has acquired since the Second World War in English. And you can see that if you have a neutral sense of propaganda, it kind of is close to marketing and advertising. So I distinguish two kinds of propaganda. Let's take the first kind. I'll start with an example. Take voter fraud, worries about voter fraud used to motivate restrictive voter ID laws. What's going on there? Well, you're given an ideal, democracy, and you're told we need to preserve this ideal. I mean, after all, there have been 10 instances of in-person same-day voter fraud between 2000 and 2012. So we need to prevent that kind of horrific abuse. We need to protect democracy. We need to implement policies that will make sure that there's no in-person same-day voter fraud. And of course, thereby disenfranchise millions, if not tens of millions of voters.
Let me ask you another kind of question. I get where you're going, but people who advocate for restrictive policies for on voting might cite this kind of thing as a reason. Now, I think it's a bad reason, right? But I wonder, does it turn into propaganda? Does propaganda require the state to adopt that as a reason for promulgating this? You see what I'm different? I mean, if John gives me a bad argument hypothetically for restrictive laws of voting, and he's just kind of one citizen or one party among other, is that propaganda, or is it propaganda only when some official organ tries to enforce that belief on me through, you know, the promulgation of
something? No, it's critical to propaganda, I think, that it employs an ideal. And the effect, in the case of what I call indirect propaganda, is to take an ideal and use it in the service of a goal that erodes that very ideal.
Oh.
So take, for instance, job creator. That expression is used to lead people to want to cut taxes on wealthy people and allow them to retain more of their money, and promotes the ideal of more jobs for everyone, but of economic health. It relies, however, on the flawed ideological belief that people with great wealth start lots of small businesses.
But somebody might hold that, what you regard as a flawed ideological belief, in good faith. I mean, they might sincerely believe. If they sincerely believe that, but they're wrong, is it still propaganda, or does it require... I mean, is it that they have to self-consciously not sincerely believe that, but purport to believe it? So it's a kind of hypocrisy or insincerity or false consciousness or something? Or if they sincerely believe this flawed ideological belief, does that still make it propaganda by your light?
Okay, so the first question is, does propaganda require insincerity? I argue clearly not. I think that even if no one ever finds out that a certain belief is false, no one ever realizes that it's an ideological belief, that it's a belief that's derived in the wrong way, that's connected to an ideology. If no one ever finds that out, it will still turn out true that there's a whole bunch of discourse that relies on that, that's going to be propaganda, even though no one realizes it. So suppose that the Soviet Union won, they conquered the world, everyone was a committed Stalinist. Party officials could die and civilization could collapse, but it would still be the case that a lot of what happened was propaganda, even though people didn't recognize it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're constructing our annual summer reading list, and we're talking to Jason Stanley from Yale University.
Why Propaganda Matters by Jason Stanley, forthcoming. What are you reading around this? There must be lots of good stuff. I know not much philosophy, but there must be lots of other good stuff that you're reading.
That's right. There's a ton of cases where, say, scientific ideals are used to erode scientific ideals. So scientific ideals are used propagandistically. So one thing I'm looking at is Khalil Mohammed's book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. And Mohammed looks at the propagandistic use of social science in the first half of the century, in the 20s and the 30s, surrounding prohibition, to connect African Americans and violence. He is arguing that social scientists were deeply implicated in the process of trying to find this kind of connection. And the end of prohibition coincides with no longer taking statistics on, say, Irish American and Italian American violence. They became assimilated to the white population. And so why would you distinguish that group from others? Why would you take specific crime statistics on that group? So then people were like, we shouldn't incarcerate them. So that is a propagandistic use of the norms of science. Also, I've recently discovered this year my favorite philosophical American philosophical tradition, which is the political philosophy tradition of Black Americans like W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Delaney, Alain Locke, and Dr. Martin Luther King, of course. And the topic of propaganda is a central topic in that in those authors. W.E.B. Du Bois's 1926 paper, Criteria of Negro Art. And Du Bois calls on Blacks, to Black artists in particular, to use propaganda to get whites to realize that Blacks are really human, to get whites to see the Black perspective. And so you see this in a lot of Black art. You see jazz songs that take a very popular white song, but then riff on it. So put a distinctive riff inside so people recognize, wow, there's someone there who's taking one of our aesthetic ideals and channeling their culture so we can see it.
So Jason, this has been a fascinating, I wouldn't say propagandistic at all, conversation. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ken and John.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
Jason Stanley from Yale University with his suggestions for anyone interested in the philosophy of propaganda.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're putting together our annual summer reading list, and we're getting suggestions from members of our community of thinkers from around the country.
Rachel in Boston, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So what's your suggestion for our summer reading list?
I think that Martha Nussbaum reading list would be appropriate for the summer. One I would really like to read is called The Fragility of Goodness.
Oh, yeah, that's an old book. That's
a
long time ago.
I think it's one of her first books.
I believe it is her very, if it's not her first book, it's one of her very first books.
Right.
And it caused her both to be famous and it caused her both to be controversial.
It is her first book. And as you mentioned, it generated a lot of interest, and I guess it ended up being kind of provocative. And I think because I've read a couple of her later books, I think it would be really interesting to sort of go back and see how she started and how she formed her thinking in this original book.
So now what, it's been a while. I remember her giving talks on this topic of the fragility of goodness way back when I was still a very young philosopher. I remember her coming to Wesleyan and giving a talk about the fragility of goodness.
I'm sure she was a very young philosopher then, too. Maybe
she was. She's a few years older than me, but she was still very young. Can you give us a quick summary of the fragility of goodness?
Well, as I understand it, she takes a what I believe is an Aristotelian approach to notions of sort of inner goodness and inner, you know, action based on the inner moral life. But she proposes that, you know, one's ethical values can be compromised and become fragile depending on environmental factors. And, you know, I think of, you know, soldiers, for example, who go to defend their country or fight for their country with the best of intentions and end up committing atrocities, for example. I can see how one's sense of inner moral values can be compromised in situations which are, you know, sort of put your judgment beyond your own control, in a sense.
Right. I mean, I do recall, again, it's been a long time since I thought about it, but I do, you're right, there is an Aristotelian view in it. And I think it's important for her that an Aristotelian view contrasts to, say, a Stoic view, because a Stoic thinks that if you concern yourself only about things within your control, then you will have a kind of invulnerability, a kind of moral invulnerability. As Epictetus says, if you concern yourself only with things within your control and never with things outside of your control, then nobody can hurt you. Nobody can be master of you. You kind of own your own self and are not subject to a certain kind of harm. And I do recall that one of Martha's point is that invulnerability, that Stoic invulnerability is not possible, is not achievable. So there's a kind of intrinsic fact of the human condition that we are in a certain sense fragile, and even if we live by virtue, and she thinks Aristotle sort of recognizes this, because for Aristotle, virtue is partly a matter of your own will and your own doing, but he says you need good external circumstances. So absent the good external circumstances, how much can virtue be damaged? How vulnerable are you? And she, as I recall, had some views about that, some highly controversial views. Some Aristotle scholars objected to the fragility of goodness and stuff like that. But you're right. It was a book that generated lots of discussion. And it's a young Martha Nussbaum, who became this force of nature eventually. I mean, she's a whirlwind. It's a young Martha Nussbaum being philosophically formed.
I think it's a great suggestion. And I think maybe I'll reread The Fragility of Goodness this summer, or maybe I'll pick her newest book, which I'm a little behind on.
So thank you very much, Rachel. And
thank you both very much. It's such a thrill to speak with you both. Thank you.
You can find a list of all the books we've talked about on the show, as well as many more suggestions from our community of thinkers, over at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, what does a guy with no time to spare read in the lazy summer months? Let's find out from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when it comes to the genre of What's Wrong with America books, conservatives have pretty much cornered the market. Liberals write them too, but they aren't as popular because they generally involve a call to action, like urging readers to buy only free-range chicken, recycle, and stop driving. Who wants to be scolded by a book? Books by conservatives only ask that you hate Obama. Anybody can do that. Don't even have to leave the house. A basic conservative tenet is American exceptionalism, which is weird because another conservative tenet is that everything going wrong in the world is because America is tricking its exceptionalism, meaning it's America's fault, by which conservatives mean liberals. That's all very confusing. None of these books have a long shelf life. They're not classics like Wealth of Nations or Democracy in America. Still, every time summer rolls around, I make a half-hearted vow to stop scooping up old Perry Mason novels at thrift shops and try to read at least some serious exposé about the mess we're in. Frankly, however, it's hard to find hard-hitting exposés at thrift shops. Well, you can find books about Iran-Contra, the Vietnam War, and the Kennedy assassination, but you will look in vain for the truth about Benghazi. That won't show up for another 10 years at least. And even then, you know, it won't be the truth, just more lies made quaint by the passage of time. Looking for role models in my vague quest, though, I turned to Bill Gates, who has a blog on which he posts books he's reading. Not a summer reading list, really, more of an agenda. First of all, he puts his books in 5 categories, education, energy, development, health, and personal. Now, who does that? What happens if categories overlap? Maybe his head explodes. Anyway, this summer's books include the latest from Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, a book called The Box, which is a history of the shipping container. Yeah, I'd read that. However Long the Night, Molly Milching's journey to help millions of African women and girls, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, Japan's Dietary Transition and Its Impact, Made in the USA, The Rise and Retreat of American Manufacturing, and Whistling Vivaldi, How Stereotypes Affect Us and What We Do. Well, crikeys, I'd fall asleep reading the dust jackets. What is this trend of having the book title be as long as the book itself? If we're not careful, God is going to take away the colon and not let us use it anymore. One book conspicuously absent from Bill Gates' agenda is the hot book of the season, and maybe the century, Capital in the 21st Century by the French economist Thomas Piketty. I read two reviews of it, one which proclaimed it extraordinarily important, and the other which was headlined, "The Most Important Book Ever Is All Wrong." So I guess culturally the book cancels itself out. And there's the problem right there. What's wrong with America is that there are too many books telling us what's wrong with America. Hey, I should write a book. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Your reading assignment is anything other than Catcher in the Rye. I'm going to hold you to that. Don't be a phony.